Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, go to our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of April 2026, and in today's podcast, I talk to journalist Nick Heim about Britain's little-known mission to Baku in 1918 and the fight to secure vital oil supplies at the end of the First World War. Nick, welcome to the podcast. Now, to begin with, can you tell us about yourself and what drew you to the so-called Battle of Baku and this curious campaign that most people have never heard of?
Yes, I call it the forgotten battle of World War One. Well, I used in a former life to be a BBC correspondent. And years and years ago, I cannot for the life of me remember why, I was doing some picture research. I was looking for black and white pictures of India before the Second World War. And I came across quite a substantial cache of films in the Imperial War Museum, which had been shot by a man called Reginald T. Jones. And among this, there was footage that Teague Jones had taken of a trip he'd made in a bullnose Morris car all the way from Bombay to London with another guy. And it involved them, to begin with, driving out of India, in what is now Pakistan, into the bottom right-hand corner of Iran, which was then known as Persia, across, I don't know, a couple of hundred miles of desert, and past dead camels and so on and so forth. And this seemed like quite an adventurous thing to do in 1928. And I investigated and discovered that he'd done the same journey in the other direction 2 years before in 1926, except this time by himself. And he very nearly died. He got stuck in the sands in southeastern Persia and had to dig himself out and was quite lucky to make it. And I thought, you sound like an interesting. Well, drove you to do this, did a bit of research, found he was indeed an interesting fellow, fascinating backstory. Decided I was going to write his biography when I had a chance, then found somebody else had already done that. But he was part of this extraordinary group of Brits around the Caspian Sea in 1918-1919, who'd been sent there for all sorts of reasons, but principally to try and prevent the Ottoman Turks, with whom we were at war, getting the oil in the city of Baku and getting across into Central Asia, which gave the British horrors. They were terrified that the Turks might invade India, actually, very unlikely, but they were desperate to prevent this. And so I thought, oh, well, that's great. There is actually here a fascinating story. And that is Mavericks is the result. And so T. Jones is one of the five Mavericks at the centre of the story.
And we'll come on to them in due course. But to use your reference of the Caspian Sea as a very good segue, for listeners unfamiliar with the Caspian Theatre, why did Britain believe it was so strategically important in 1918? And can you start by telling us exactly where we are talking about in terms of geography?
This is where you get your mental atlas out, or better still, you actually go and consult an atlas or an online map. The Caspian Sea is the world's largest lake. It is fed by the Volga, the great Russian river. It has no outlet. It's about 750 miles from north to south and 250 from east to west. So it's big. It's a proper sea. And it is east of the Black Sea. If you find the Black Sea, Crimea and so on, in between the Black Sea and the Caspian is an area known as the Caucasus, which is largely mountain, but to the south of the mountains there are, in modern geographical terms, there are three countries. There is Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. And Baku is the capital of Azerbaijan. But at the beginning of the First World War, it was just another Russian city on the shore of the Caspian, the western shore of the Caspian. I say it was just another Russian city, but actually it was of global significance because it was a very important center of oil production. In 1900, half the world's oil had come from Baku. And the significance of Baku in 1918 was that that oil could have been of tremendous benefit to Britain and France's enemies, to the Germans, to the Austro-Hungarians, and to the Turks. And the British were desperate to keep it out of Turkish hands. The difficulty was that in October 1917 we'd had the Russian Revolution, and Russia had crashed out of the First World War. And this, these enormous Russian armies, which had kept a million Germans tied up on the Eastern Front, had been opposing the Ottoman Turks in the Caucasus, these armies just basically spontaneously disappeared. And all the soldiers went home, and the new Bolshevik government in Moscow, Lenin and Trotsky and so on, made peace with the Germans. And suddenly there was nothing to stop the Turks from driving eastwards across the Caucasus, seizing Baku. And as I say, the thing that gave the British particular tremors, the fear that they might cross the Caspian and, if nothing else, encourage the enormous Muslim population in India to rebel against the British. So you might have a kind of repeat of the Indian Mutiny. And that was what these chaps were trying to prevent.
And your book looks at five extraordinary individuals, and these are, for just for summary, Dunsterville, McDonnell, Noel, Rawlinson, and T. Jones, who you've all already mentioned. How did you decide on these figures at the heart of your story?
Well, T. Jones, I've already explained, he was the way in. And when it was clear that there wasn't much point in writing a biography of him because it had already been done, I read the work of wonderful writer and historian called Peter Hopkirk, who is most famous for a book about the great game played between Russia and Britain in the 19th century for sort of influence in Central Asia. But Hopkirk also wrote a book about the Caspian Theatre in 1918-1919. And I discovered three of the other four characters in Hopkirk. And I thought these guys, they're all unusual men. They're risk takers. They're characters of, if you met them, you'd never forget them. These were people with real personality. And they were also brave in most cases, you could say reckless. And I thought any story involving them is likely to be fun. And so it proved.
One of the striking things in your introduction is the vivid description of the Dirty Volcano and the North Staffordshire's Stand. Tell us about this incident in the background, and what do you think it reveals about the discipline and training and morale in such conditions?
Well, one of the five characters is this chap, Lionel Dunsterville, Major General Lionel Dunsterville, who was actually quite famous in his day because he had been at school with Rudyard Kipling, and Kipling had immortalized Dunsterville in a series of school stories that Kipling wrote, sort of semi-autobiographical, called Storky and Co. And Dunsterville was the model for Storky, the sort of leader of the little gang of three schoolboys, horrified the Victorians. They behaved like schoolboys do rather than as Victorians thought schoolboys should. And Dunsterville was well known. And I think he got the job of trying to stop the Turks from getting Baku without being given an army with which to do that, because the planners in the War Office knew that he was the model for Storky, and they knew that what they were asking was pretty unusual, and it was going to need a pretty unusual sort of man to do it. And the original plan, which was conceived in December 1917 after the Russian Revolution, when it became clear that these Russian armies were demobilizing, was to send Dunsterville and a whole lot of money to bribe the inhabitants of the Caucasus, the Georgians and the Armenians, principally, not the Azerbaijanis, because they were Muslim like the Turks and couldn't be trusted, bribe them to fight the Turks. If there were no orthodox regular Russian armies to do the job, then perhaps we could get the locals to do it. And so Dunsterville set off in January 1918, in a convoy of 41 Ford cars and vans, several of which were carrying large sums of money, set off from Baghdad, which the British had recently captured from the Turks, and drove, this is in the depths of winter, some 600 or 700 miles through Persia to get to the Caspian Sea, where he was going to take a boat and go to Baku, and then actually go on to Tiflis, Tbilisi, we call it now, the capital of Georgia, where he was going to disperse all this money. And it never worked out. He discovered that the Bolsheviks were in control in Baku, and the Bolsheviks had a sort of cell, a satellite cell on the coast of the Caspian in Persia, and the Bolsheviks weren't going to allow him to proceed when he got to the Caspian, because they were desperate to stop the war. I mean, the Great War was incredibly unpopular in Russia by this stage, and the Bolsheviks came to power partly because they were enthusiastic about preventing it. So they weren't going to allow Dunstable to continue, because his avowed aim was to keep the war going, to keep the fighting going in the Caucasus. So they said, well, we're not going to let you get on a ship. And this was somewhat humiliating, and he was forced to mark time in Persia for about 5 months. Now, during that time, he was gradually reinforced. He actually got some fighting soldiers, never more than about 2,000, of whom about 1,200 got to Baku itself. And among them was the 7th Battalion of the North Staffordshire Regiment. And as you say, they fought a desperate battle on the outskirts of Baku on the 26th of August to try to prevent the Turks, who by this stage had Baku under siege, from getting into the center of Baku. And they were on this dirty volcano, they called it, which is a mud volcano. I'd never heard of mud volcanoes, but apparently they're quite common in areas where there are oil deposits, and they periodically erupt, and lots of flame and methane comes out of them, and so on. The North Staffordshires fought literally to the death, D Company of the 7th Battalion of the North Staffs. They were basically wiped out. 70 of them were killed. All 14 officers were killed or wounded. It was extraordinary. And one of the things that struck me was that the British, when they got to Baku, found that the defence was in the hands of local volunteers who were hopeless soldiers, because nobody had, you know, taught them how to be soldiers. They didn't have proper officers. And here you had a bunch of Brits who were, by this stage in the war, mostly probably conscripts, the men of the North Staffords. And yet, because they were part of a trained and disciplined force, the British Army knew what it was doing when it took raw recruits and bashed them into shape. They fought like tigers, even as the Armenian volunteers, Russian volunteers around them were, you know, legging it back to town. And that's the scene with which the book opens. And it really, really struck me. As individuals, the North Staffords had no skin on the game, mostly in the game. None of them would have known where Baku was. The place meant nothing to them, but it was their job to fight. They were trained and disciplined, and so they fought. And even though the Armenians risked probable massacre from the Turks, a fear that came true when the Turks captured Baku, they did massacre a lot of Armenians. They were nominally fighting for their lives, but in fact they were incapable of doing it.
And the men you describe, many of them were soldiers, but you also describe them as mavericks, risk takers, eccentrics, and sometimes rogues. How did these, I suppose, qualities shape their effectiveness, either for better or worse?
Yes, I called them mavericks because by modern lights they are. Actually, a couple of the reviewers of the book have been very kind, have nonetheless said actually they weren't mavericks. They were just typical of British empire builders and imperialists of their age. And I suppose there's quite a lot of truth in that. Certainly the empire gave them an opportunity to flourish. Most of them had gone to India and had joined either the Indian Army or the Indian Political Service, because that was where you went if you were a young Brit to find adventure. One of them, Rawlinson, had not. He found his thrills elsewhere. He was a pioneering racing driver. He was a pioneering pilot. He held British Pilot's License number 3. He had an extraordinary life. And one of them was a diplomat by default. He was an oil executive in Baku who, when the previous British vice consul had been threatened with assassination and had legged it, McDonnell was put into his position in 1905. But he too, I mean, he was a man who, you know, they liked adventure. They liked different. They like to do things which took them away from the often rather stultifying conventional life that they would otherwise have led in Britain itself. And the empire, therefore, has a lot to answer for. But in the background of this story, there looms both the Russian Revolution, but also the British Empire. And that's one reason I gave it the subtitle I did, Empire, Oil, Revolution, and the Forgotten Battle. I learned quite a lot about the British Empire and how it worked and what motivated people in the empire.
Yeah, it seems, just to digress, that they seem to have extreme individualism. And how much are they motivated by, I suppose, the pursuit of self-glory or pursuit of the mission?
I think several of them were terrified of boredom. They were, of course, all nominally members of a hierarchical, disciplined organization. They were all either in the army, or in Ranald MacDonald's case, they were working for the Foreign Office, and there were rules about that. There were rules. But they weren't necessarily people who kept to the rules. And one of them in particular, Edward Noel, he'd been an Indian Army soldier and transferred to something, again, I'd never heard of till I started this book, called the Indian Political Service, which was about 100 guys who most of them were tasked with sitting alongside the nominally sovereign rulers of large chunks of India. You often get this. The British in India did not rule much of the country directly. About 25-30% of the population was ruled by nominally independent princes, but there were these chaps from the Indian Political Service who sat alongside the princes and made sure they didn't step out of line. And the Indian Political Service guys also served as consuls in areas around the Indian Empire. So Persia was a classic example. It was supposedly an independent country, but it was covered in British consuls, all of whom were members of the Indian Political Service, all of whom answered to the Indian government. And Noel was one of these, and they had extraordinary freedom of action. I mean, he ran a private army at one stage of 200 horsemen. And the bit that still baffles me, if anybody can answer this, I'd be fascinated to know if they've got any suggestions. He, at the end of 1918, in September, October 1918, he was based in Persia. He went to Tehran, the capital of Persia, to confer with the British minister, the ambassador there. And then, without apparently telling anyone or getting any permission from anyone, including his bosses, he went to Russia, across the Caspian Sea, passing through back on the way. And then he went to Petrograd, St. Petersburg, where he must have arrived very shortly before the October Revolution. And he turned up at the embassy there. And the embassy sent a message back to London. We know he got that because the embassy sent a message back to London a few days, a couple of weeks later, saying he's going back to Persia now and he's going to take our diplomatic bag with him. And I have no idea why he went. But this is the middle of war. He's arguably deserted his post in Persia. He's popped up in St. Petersburg. What was he doing? And then he sets off back to Persia. And acts the request of London. He gathers intelligence along the way and meets various individuals who might put up resistance to the Turks and later the Bolsheviks, and he sends reports back to London. But then he just kind of disappears. And the government of India, which is his nominal employer, finally says, where is he? And nobody knows. The Foreign Office doesn't know. The War Office doesn't know. The India Office in London doesn't know. He's gone completely off the radar. And he only emerges a few weeks later. Now, that, I think, is maverick behaviour. And because he was the sort of chap he was, he didn't, you know, there's no written record. He did keep a diary later in life, but he doesn't appear to have been keeping a diary at this point. So we have no idea what he was doing. But if anybody's got any suggestions or, you know, family stories, Edward Noel, do let me know.
Now, to tell the story of these amazing people, you draw heavily on memoirs, diaries, many of them embellished and maybe unreliable. How did you navigate those sources and balance colourful anecdotes, maybe for posterity, with historical accuracy?
Well, you don't want to dump the colourful anecdotes because they're one of the things that make people want to read the book. So you keep them in. And the trick is to try to put in health warnings where necessary. And I have put in a number of sort of general health warnings. I now think, actually, I was a little too credulous in a couple of points. There are There's some wonderful stories Ranald MacDonald tells of traveling across the Caucasus in a private train and being ambushed by people and so on. And I say at the beginning, MacDonald was not a reliable witness. I think I probably ought to have shoved in a couple of other caveats there. But I mean, you start from the assumption that what people put in a memoir is reasonably accurate, and then you compare it with either what other people say or what's in the newspapers, or most importantly, what is in the official cables. There is an enormous amount of telegraph traffic, cable traffic involving these men and the people they worked with in Persia and India and so on, all of which is now preserved in the archive of the India Office, which of course was abolished in the 1940s with Indian independence. That archive is now in the British Library, and that's absolute treasure trove for historians. I spent hours there, and I merely really only scratched the surface. So you accept what they say in memoirs until something contradicts it. What did come as a bit of a shock was that T. Jones, who was my starting point, he wrote a diary at the time that he was around the Caspian, which was published shortly after his death. He died in 1988 at the age of 99. And he had, in fact, just published his first book, an account of that first journey he made across Persia by himself, oldest debut author in British publishing history, I think. But shortly after his death, Peter Hopkirk, who we've already mentioned, worked up the diary that he kept in 1918-1919 and published that. And that was, you know, a very important starting point. It's only well into the research that I realized that not only had he sort of gingered up a few stories and so on, he had plain invented whole episodes, and much of it, what looks like a documentary record largely written at the time, turns out to be fiction. I mean, absolute fiction, just made stuff up. That was interesting. There are possible explanations for it, and if you read the book, Teague James's career, you may, the penny may drop, you may understand why he was the sort of person who did this. But he was somebody who was very, very keen to invent a life and a persona for himself that was frankly rather more exciting than the original. I mean, he lived an interesting life, absolutely no question about that, but he was keen to make it even more exciting and thrilling.
Now, the campaign in Baku sits at the intersection of empire, oil and espionage. How far was this really about protecting Britain's Indian Empire as much as winning the wider First World War?
It was both. They wanted to keep the oil out of the hands of the Ottoman Turks and the Germans. Remember, this is August, September 1918. We now know with hindsight that the war was about to end and that the Central Powers were about to collapse. They didn't know that at the time. And they were afraid that the war was going to go on for many, many months more, and that oil would have been incredibly useful to the Germans and the Turks. So they were very anxious to prevent that. But as I said earlier, for the British, that was the anxiety about oil was common to all the Allies. But for the British in particular, there was this fear that the Turks, who were, of course, Muslim, who did several times during the First World War try to launch a kind of global jihad, and get other Muslims in North Africa and Asia and so on to rise up against the Allied powers. There was this fear that the Turks would cross the Caspian into Central Asia, get close to India, they get into Persia, they get into Afghanistan, and that Britain's Muslim population in India would rebel, would rise up. And given how important India and particularly its manpower were to the British war effort and to the British Empire, this could have been disastrous. So that was a really significant factor.
Now, I mean, I suppose when we talk about these individuals, one individual of similar character in a different place springs to mind, and that is T.E. Lawrence in Arabia. And again, his exploits have become well known and part of the national memory. Why do you think your story, or the story that you cover of those amazing individuals, has been forgotten for so long?
None of them was either as good a writer or as spectacular a self-publicist as T.E. Lawrence. I mean, there's a sort of revisionist approach to Lawrence that says he didn't really make much difference to anything, but he just talked about it tremendously well. And of course, at crucial moments, he was in London where he ensured, first of all, that he had the ear of senior politicians and so on. And also he became, I think in his own, I think at one stage he used the term, you know, I've become sort of matinee idol. My chaps were all in Central Asia. The one who went back to London, who had perhaps sufficient public profile and charisma to have done a bit of a Lawrence, was Dunsterville. But he was in many ways the most orthodox of the five. He was a military officer, and he knew that he'd blown it. I mean, he and his men stayed in Baku, hugely, overwhelmingly outnumbered, for 6 weeks. So they kept the place out of enemy hands for 6 weeks. That was not a negligible achievement. But in the end, they were forced to evacuate. And he lost his temper with his superiors and sent some blistering telegrams telling them it was all their fault. So he, at one stage, he was fearful that he would be court martialed for insubordination. And although he wrote a book about the episode, which he published in 1920, he first went back to India. So again, he wasn't in London, he was in India. And when he came back, finally retired, came back to London and wrote the book, it was all a bit past history. And in any case, I think he knew that what he had done, though interesting, was nothing compared with the alleged exploits of Lawrence. So, and so some of the other guys had reasons for not publicising what they'd done. And one of them, Rawlinson, was very unlucky, actually, because shortly after the war, he was sent to Turkey, where he was supposed to help oversee Turkish disarmament. And the Turks took umbrage and banged him up in jail for, I think, nearly 2 years. He nearly starved. And he was only released as part of a sort of prisoner swap. So he wasn't about to, you know, bang the drum and explain what they'd done. But yeah, I mean, Lawrence was a unique figure. And my chaps, though interesting, none of them were quite Lawrence's league.
So tell us about some of their later lives. You already touched on Teague Jones becoming an author at 99. Which of their sort of, I suppose, post-war stories surprised you the most?
I won't give any spoilers. So I'm not going to talk in detail about Teague Jones, but he did have a really quite extraordinary afterlife, as it were. Dunsterville, he was much older than most of the others, and he kind of faded into, I was going to say, comfortable retirement, actually, because he was living on an Indian Army pension. It wasn't especially comfortable, and he spent quite a lot of his time in the 20s and 30s living in pensions in Italy and France and so on, because it was so much cheaper than living in England. Rawlinson, as I say, was also quite an old man at this stage. He was banged up in Turkish jail. And although he writes about it in his memoirs with great brio, I think that was a pretty traumatic experience for him. And I think it also broke his health. I think he died earlier than he would otherwise have done because of it. MacDonald, again, he became a journalist, MacDonald, which is, of course, what many people do when they can't think of anything else to do. The Foreign Office didn't want him anymore. He was something in the city for a bit. And then he became quite a good journalist and, again, wrote an entertaining memoir that you can't believe a lot of it. And Edward Knowle, who was the chap who sort of shot off to Petrograd without telling everybody what he was doing, while the Battle of Baku was going on, he had been taken hostage by Bolshevik sympathizers and nationalists in Persia and imprisoned for 5 months and kept in solitary confinement in chains for 65 days. He did actually get to Baku just before the evacuation while the battle was still in progress. But I think that experience also messed with his head, and he was never quite the same again. But he was an adventurous. The story I like best about Knowle, who was, amongst other things, he was an opium addict and he was an enthusiast for alternative technologies and all sorts of things. He decided, he went back to India and he had a job in the Northwest Frontier Province. And he decided that rather than fuel cars driving around India on petrol, it would be much cheaper to fuel them on charcoal, because they produced a lot of charcoal in India. And as proof of concept, he decided he was going to drive in the 1930s, about 1932, he was going to drive two Rolls Royces from London to India. And one of them was conventional, but the other one was going to be fueled by charcoal. And there was a sort of press call outside the RAC club in Pall Mall before they set off. And one chap there said, "I don't think they'll get beyond Fontainebleau." And he was wrong, actually. Then they threw the charcoal device away in Dover. The whole thing was a complete fiasco. But I like that about Noel. You know, he had this harebrained idea. He was going to show that it worked. When it didn't work, well, hell, they just carried on anyway, conventionally fueled, and eventually, after, you know, many adventures, did get to India. So he was an unusual man. And late in life, he'd been married, and his wife had divorced him. But late in life, when he must have been mid-60s, he was a Roman Catholic, he married a Belgian artist who was also an archaeologist and, I think, a bit of a mystic. So, I mean, you know, that's an interesting life.
And finally, what does your story of these mavericks tell us about the nature of empire, the limits of British power, and the legacy of the First World War beyond the Western Front?
It tells us, as I think, again, I said earlier, it tells us that empire was a great playground for unusual and adventurous people, particularly men. It also shows us the limits of empire. We tend to think of, you know, the British Empire as a unit. Actually, particularly in Asia, it was an odd, rather sprawling affair, which had no hard fixed borders, and places could suddenly find themselves almost by accident, by sort of process of absorption, part of the British Empire. And one of the things that interested me was that Persia, which was a nominally an independent neutral country but was a political basket case, central government was all over the place, it was a lawless and so on and so forth, the British had all these vice consuls and consuls in Persia, and they were gradually taking it over. And had the First World War not intervened and had other, you know, counterfactual history, I think Persia would have been part of the British Empire by, you know, the mid-1920s. As it was, the war overstretched Britain financially and in other ways, and that didn't happen. Again, there was a serious idea around that in 1919, the British might take over what is now Turkmenistan. Reginald Teague Jones's job was to prop up an anti-Bolshevik government in Turkmenistan, I would say called Transcaspia, to the extent, actually, this government had no money, the British printed money for them, and Teague Jones signed every note himself with another officer. And he was propping up this outfit. And at one stage, it was seriously considered, should we make this sort of another British protectorate? Should we extend the British Empire to cover this area as well? And it became clear back in London that there was no political appetite for that, and there certainly wasn't any money, and all the British soldiers, you know, wanted to go home, they wanted to be demobilized. So it never happened. But I learned quite a lot about the way the British Empire operated writing and researching this book, and in particular the almost accidental nature by which parts of the empire became British imperial possessions or part of the sort of British imperial hegemony.
Nick, on that fascinating bombshell, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Rusman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS21. 95. Until next time.